Three, two, one.
That sounded good.
Yeah, it did.
Good job, Zach. Zach's a musician, so...
You can always tell a musician from the clap sync.
I think I'm probably the least musically inclined in this chat, but yeah, I appreciate it.
Well, and Tony actually plays the clap, so that's unfair, too.
See? Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, I can't compete with that.
I studied at Juilliard. Studied the clap at Juilliard.
Oh, boy.
All right, well, once we start, I guess, Seth, I'll let you introduce Zach.
No, I want whatever your first impression is. I think that'll be better.
That's literally what every single person on here says. They never want me to, like, check with them first. They want to see what I'm going to say. And I'll try not to ruin your whole reputation.
Yeah, let's only use our knowledge of Zach. So one of us could be like, our guest today is Zach, a man who wandered into the video chat eating ice cream with some spooky balloons behind him.
They're blow molds. Come on, man.
We were playing chat roulette, and he was the first person not masturbating who came up. And so he's on the podcast.
Well, we can't see him masturbating.
I learned my lesson last time. Yeah.
Well, so, like, are you okay with us using your last name?
You can pretty much do whatever. My Twitter presence is pretty out there, so I really don't care about any of that. So you can go nuts.
Cool.
You can tell people where I live. I don't give a shit.
And this is so you're like our horror expert. That's really your last name, Butcher?
that is my legal last name. Yeah, I was born into loving horror movies.
Yeah, that's great.
I've never considered that it could be a fake last name.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, when I started my podcast, people always thought it was like a fake thing. They're like, oh, like spooky. And I was like, no, that's just my name.
This is our good friend Zach Bloodshed.
That's right, yeah.
Horror expert.
Zach Slasher.
Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, your podcast dad, here to judge the intentions of your most difficult and unpleasant movie boyfriends. I am Mark Batavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're covering the new French Extremity, a wave of some of the most extreme and graphically violent horror films ever to come out of France that also inspired the 2000s explosion of torture porn in the U.S. We are going to focus on Alexandre Aja's blood-soaked 2003 slasher High Tension and Pascal Logie's 2008 ode to bodily suffering, Martyrs.
Can I call you Daddy, Mark?
Please. Nothing but the best for my daughters. Nothing but
the best for my daughters.
Oh, jeez.
Mark and his daughters.
Seth, would you like to introduce our very special guest for this extreme episode?
Yeah. I started hanging out on this podcast, Unwatchables, with extreme content, and there's an extreme person that I know in the Akron area, who is a part of an extreme, I guess, is it hardcore? Would I call it a hardcore band, Zach?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Specifically, the lyrics are about horror films, giallo horror films, if I'm not mistaken. He's the lead singer, screamer, as the kids say, screamer. And he has also run various, like over COVID, kept me going with these movie showings over Discord of just like silly. Some of them were silly. There was like the Danzig movie that you showed, the one that Danzig directed and shit, and a bunch of horror movies. And you also like kind of did it like you were, you know, kind of hosting it. It was really charming. It was fun. There was like old commercials that you would put in. You're just a genuine horror movie enthusiast, I can tell. And I've always appreciated that. And I knew we had to have you on for one of our horror movie episodes. So do you want to rebuttal or correct me on any of what I just said?
Did you say our guest's name?
No.
Oh,
no.
I buried the lead. His last name is Butcher.
Zach Butcher.
Butcher.
It's true.
And it's not fake. It's a real last name.
It's legal, baby. That's right.
It's legal. He's a legal killer.
You know, growing up, I was super into horror movies and still kind of am, but especially when I was younger, that was always the like aisle at the video store that I ran to first. And I remember seeing a lot of these movies or movies like these, like in the early 2000s, there was always some sort of grisly horror movie you could go see in the theaters that I think was inspired by a lot of these movies, and in some cases even crossed over to play here. So this is, I'm somewhat well-versed, I think, in this scene, but probably not as much as Zach is.
Speaking of early 2000s like horror, isn't Aja the director of High Tension? He did the Hills Have Eyes remake?
Yes.
Yeah, he had a strange like little thing. He did High Tension and people seemed to really like it, and they were like, come make movies in America, and they just kept giving him things that would get progressively worse. It was the Hills Have Eyes remake and then Mirrors and P2. I think he did Crawl. Oh. Crawl wasn't bad.
I liked Crawl. Crocodile Core.
Yeah.
He was definitely one of the directors from this wave of films who's still in Hollywood making movies and genre movies for the most part. So I think that's why that's a good movie to start with. I didn't really know the origins of like where this whole term came from of New French Extremity, but this was actually a term that was coined in an article by a critic named James Quant for Art Forum magazine in 2004. And he just threw it into this article, which is now, you know, the title of the Wikipedia page and what the whole, you know, kind of trend was called. And so I read this article, which is very long and dense, and basically just focuses on this trend in the early 2000s of just really extreme content of sneaking into these French movies with a really graphic focus on bodies being, you know, mutilated and in physical suffering and taboos, and not just in terms of horror. He was specifically talking about French filmmakers like François Ozon and Bruno Dumont. And then started bringing in some people we've even talked about on this podcast, like Michael Haneke. He mentions Gaspar Noé and Irreversible. And then very specifically, one that we fully covered on here, which is Trouble Every Day, that I think fits right into this too, which we were not a fan of on this podcast. But it was interesting to see at that being the kind of beginnings of this, not so much a movement, because they weren't really all under the same umbrella or with an ethos, but I think that you could see it start to seep over into the U.S. with movies like Saw and Hostel, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake from 2003, like these very brutal movies.
I still never got through that one. So mean.
Yes, mean. These movies are very mean.
They're very mean. They had to keep up with the Japanese got their extreme. What are we going to do here in France? Got to keep up.
There was a big big push for that, just especially like with the Hollywood approach of what can we take from the Japanese, what can we take from the French and like their movements, and what can we do here? And it seemed like 80% of them were remakes of either really well-known or like B-grade movies. You know, like you had the Texas Chainsaw remake, you had the Hills Have Eyes remake, and then you would kind of go down the line into My Bloody Valentine, Friday the 13th, the Rob Zombie Halloween, and it was just kind of pushing this new thing of a modern approach, but a modern approach being how gross can we make it because that's what we think people want. They moved further and further away from like the torture porn term and moving further into this is what we think kids want. So, you know, you've got the Texas Chainsaw remake where a girl pulls a gun out of her vagina, and then you move into the Halloween remake with, you know, all the typical Rob Zombie tropes of white trash American people. And it ruined a lot of things, but I guess, you know, there's also a lot of people that seem to really hold those near and dear. The Black Christmas remake adding all that extra stuff.
Yeah, Wrong Turn.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, I remember seeing that in the theater.
Yeah, it's interesting that we like kind of now it seems like we're so far away from that anymore. Like everything is kind of fighting against that. It's like, you know, it's heady, man. It's A24, and it's about something this time. You know.
Yeah, the elevated horror.
Definitely, because I remember, you know, around when The Sixth Sense came out, it was all ghost and haunted house movies. And then after The Grudge and, you know, The Ring were so successful, it was all these J-horror remakes like those and, you know, The Eye, all kinds of, you know, really bad movies, but not all just remakes, a lot of ones that just kind of kept that same spirit going. And then at one point, it was this thing that started with the New French Extremity, I want to say, that kind of migrated over here and turned into what we see as what was labeled at the time as torture porn, whether that's fair or not. And yeah, and now it's all elevated horror where everything is like a metaphor and a thesis about something. And I'm really hoping that that's wearing itself out now, too. And we can maybe get back to, you know, the inexplicable or something that is a, you know, more of an immediate threat and not just a giant movie of, you know, symbolism and trauma. that would be great. But we'll see what's next. I don't know what the next thing will be.
I think us getting Five Cream, like making fun of the elevated horror era, will hopefully mean that we'll get two or three more years of those knockoffs and then we'll move into something else altogether. That seems to normally be how it goes. You know, Scream came out and then there was all the Scream knockoffs, and then Scream 2 came out and then all the shitty sequels, you know, continuing and reaching this legacy era of, you know, fucking Texas Chainsaw 2020, Halloween 2018.
Ooh, all garbage.
I liked Halloween 2018 well enough. Texas Chainsaw 2020, I was not real into.
Yeah, I decided to skip that one.
Yeah. But I'm also in the minority. I think 2 and Next Generation are the only two that are actually worth watching.
Whoa. So,
big fans.
You're not into the first one.
You fucking hate it.
Whoa, you're so hardcore. This is why you're a hardcore
hot
take. Man.
I hate That's this. A hot I hate take. This.
Sizzle. Sizzling. Sizzling. Oh, damn.
Oh, boy. Well, I can't wait to get the takes on these movies.
Well, this movie is kind of short. It's like 90 minutes on the dot or something. It kind of breezes by in a way that like throwing up breezes by.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when I was you know, looking at this whole scene, there was a film blogger, Matt Smith, who basically singled out 5 movies as being part of this new wave of French horror. And the earliest one is High Tension from 2003. It includes other ones like a movie called Them from 2006, which is kind of a strangers type story with mysterious people showing up outside somebody's house.
It's a real good movie.
Yeah. Another one called Frontiers and another one called Inside, which actually I might have pushed for us to include on this episode, except I have plans for that in a future episode with a different theme. And then at the end of that is Martyrs in 2008. So I thought these would be good picks because they kind of go in the beginning and then the tail end of these kind of movies. And High Tension in particular, as far as I know, is the only one that got a wide release in the United States. And I remember seeing it in the theater when it came out in 2003.
Oh, see, I never saw it in the theater, but it really struck me anytime I would see it at like Family Video or something when it came out, like on DVD. I just remember being like, really like, whoa. It was just such a haunting image to me because I was a big old wimpy kid and I was like not ready in like whenever this came out at like video stores and stuff to watch something like this. But it was just wild to see this woman on the cover with a slashed fucked up face with a fucking concrete saw and just blood on the wall behind her and just like wondering like, what could even be inside this movie? And it was like also like the first time I felt like I had seen like something like that, where it's like it's a kind of a pretty young woman who is gonna kill me.
Whoa.
Who knew?
And this movie's probably the reason that we didn't see more experiments with releasing these movies in the theaters in the US, because it screened at the Midnight Madness series at the Toronto International Film Festival. And Lionsgate picked it up. They spent like $14 million in advertising and putting it out there. And then it only made $3.6 million. And I think part of the problem was that, first of all, they dubbed it into English very poorly. I remember watching it in the theater and it was...
Oh, I wondered about that.
A very bad dubbing job. And then strangely, there were all these places where it still had subtitles. They would suddenly switch to the French, like when they were swearing or something. And then they would still be subtitles. And then we'd go back to the bad dubbing. And it was very distracting. And they also made a whole bunch of cuts to it to get an R rating. So hopefully anyone who's seen this movie today, it's on like the unrated DVD or Blu-ray release. Because they did significantly trim some of the gore in it. And it's kind of funny watching it now, especially with the movies that would come soon after, like the Saw films and Hostel, where it seemed like there were no holds barred. Like it doesn't seem like anything that would have trouble getting an R rating today or even a few years after this movie came out.
Sure.
But I guess they were concerned about it at the time. But it had a cool trailer with that Sonic Youth cover of the Carpenter song.
Oh, yeah.
It was very enticing. There's no dialogue, tellingly, in the trailer. But that got me out to see it. And I was disappointed at the time, and I wasn't sure how much of that was chalked up to how it was presented. But yeah, interesting experiment.
The American trailer that I remember seeing pretty widely also spoils the end of the movie.
Whoa,
and they were
really?
Just like, oh, yeah, it's fine. You know, like, let's just promote it like that.
Oh, Lord.
So I'm not really sure how that went. I did not see it in 2003. I didn't see it until 2009. I was entering high school, and I remember watching it, and it was terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It still is, like, brings me back to an old kind of feeling when I would watch these movies for the first time after, again, like, spending even my early teenage years avoiding horror films. I was like, my later teenage years where I finally actually started to watch them, and just like how intense it all was to finally be exposed to this kind of shit and like throw myself into the deep end with certain movies like this, which it's just like, it still gives me that like feeling like I'm just like going to start sweating and like I'm going to be sick or something. There is just such, it's an intense, high tension going on. I was almost going to say it without it being like a reference to the title, but it is.
I always thought that this was one of the stranger titles for a film, because I know it was released in the UK as Switchblade Romance.
Yeah, which is way cooler. Is
probably, yeah, a better title.
Oh, really? I love this title. I love the double meaning.
Almost a spoiler, but
yeah,
I don't know. It's like, do you want to watch a comedy that's called Really Funny? Like, it just seems like a strange way to the thing to put, because it doesn't refer to, well, okay, maybe I guess there could be some way it refers to something in the film. This is one of those, we should just say up front, that has such a movie defining twist at the end. It's kind of like talking about The Sixth Sense without getting right into the big twist. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel. I was thinking maybe we could talk about it for a little bit until we get to that point in the movie, and then we'll discuss the twist, maybe just to give a sense of what it's like to watch the first time without knowing.
Yeah, that's fine by me.
But we should definitely, we'll have to get into it.
If you want to hear about martyrs, you can like just scrub to the middle when the little circle goes to the middle of the line. Do that.
Sure, we'll give you a warning before we spoil the hell out of this movie.
Or just watch the trailer, like I said.
Oh, right. Don't do
but
that.
I've been mad about it for a long time.
That's absurd. But yeah, so we talked a little about Alexandre Aja, who this was his like second film. And I think you can tell right away that he has just a really good eye. He makes very handsome films like this. I think the only ones I've seen, I did see The Hills Have Eyes remake and Piranha 3D,
which I remember enjoying
at the time.
Yeah.
Piranha 3D is great.
Yeah, and I didn't even get to see it in 3D, which I really regret, but I still had fun with it at home. So he's a very capable director.
That is what gets me on this, and it's not the same director, but Martyrs as well. It seems to be, at least with these two movies, I don't know if it goes throughout the French Extremity, but a real close attention to color and mood with cinematography is such a big deal, and in a very different way than what we got in America, like as a result of these, which I feel like are very like kind of bland. I just really love this movie and Martyrs visually, especially when it comes to the way they showcase gore as like almost like the blood splattering being this like psychedelic light show or something almost, while still being like earthy and very gross and realistic.
Yeah, I think this filmmaker in particular is very influenced by those 70s movies like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like The Hills Have Eyes, which again, he went ahead and remade. So there was clearly a personal connection there, which is interesting because, you know, those movies have very gritty, almost docu-realistic kind of feels to them. And almost in the same way that, you know, Rob Zombie is influenced by those movies, yet his film, their films don't really look like them. It's these, I feel like Aja's films are much more polished, you know, and professional looking, even though they get really extreme with the gore. And it's interesting to see about like him and Rob Zombie, I could see like geeking out all night together about these 70s movies, yet their approaches are so different in how they incorporate those into their own style.
Yeah. I think that approach to the cinematography really helps the opening of this movie, which is supposed to sort of lull you into, I don't know, there's definitely a flashback at the beginning that foretells like, well, it's a flash forward or whatever you want to call it, but foretells that things are not going to go well. But at the same time, there is this beautiful opening where these two women are driving in a car together. It's they're like best friends, and they're going to the Marie's, I think it's Marie's house, family house. And there is it's just all shot so beautifully. It feels like a kind of just like a French art movie. At least like when I first saw it, I was just like, how is this going to turn into something that looks like the front cover of the movie? It seemed impossible. And it makes it even more like jarring when it finally does take that turn. I think it's really effective in that way, at least for like an American audience not used to that, I guess, especially during this time.
Well, and there's an opening before the opening, which actually both of these movies we're going to talk about open with the heroine running from something after having something terrible happening to them. And in this film, it's we kind of get her sitting in a chair and just saying over and over again, I won't let anyone come between us anymore, which turns out to be significant. But then they try to frame the flashback like it's a dream. They show her waking up in a car and saying, oh, I had a dream that someone was chasing me. But it is actually a flash forward. And again, I'm going to do my best not to talk yet about how that's all setting up this twist at the end. But yeah, until we get to that point, this is, how about the introduction to this killer, huh?
What an absolute scene, dude. this movie just got added to Shudder, I don't know, like a month ago maybe. And I saw it was on, and I was talking to my fiance, Becca. I was like, oh, you know, you love French stuff. Becca took French for most of high school, most of college. You know, they're very invested in France as a whole. And I was like, this is part of the French extreme movement. This is a great crossover for you and I. And so I put the movie on, and I was like, the first time I saw this, it scared me really bad. And Becca was like, okay, I don't know if I really want to watch that, but all right. And then, you know, the first 4 minutes, you get the pop song, you get them driving in the car, very... Becca's like, yep, okay. And then minute five, that scene, and Becca was just like, you can turn this off at any point. I'm done. Like, I'm good.
Oh, that was the moment. Yeah, so the scene comes right after that nice scene where it is like, which it begins the tension because you can kind of see.
It's low tension at this point.
That's right, yeah. We're
low to medium tension.
On the scale.
I guess that's my thing. I can't tell anymore because I've seen this already. Like, once you know the twist, it's hard to know. Yeah. If, like, could you tell that there is something going on at this point already, like in the car?
There's hints once they get to the house about there being some kind of a jealousy and attraction from the girl to the friend. Especially when she's sitting outside and happens to see this window that's perfectly placed where she can watch her friend shower.
Yeah.
Really strange, like low window, just perfect placement to see the topless friend showering. And she clearly has some feelings about that. But at this point, we have been introduced to the killer very briefly, which we alluded to, and where he's getting some of the best kind of head, which is severed. And it looks like he's getting oral in a car. And then when he's done, he just tosses the decapitated head out and it lands. And I don't know. It's a little silly, isn't it? I mean, it's disturbing, but it's also so, that is so over the top.
I think it's so silly how good it is. Come on.
It's just crazy. Yeah, he's in like a, he's the most generically like terrifying, large, gross man in like a scary armored car looking thing. And yeah, he's giving himself head on a severed girl's head. And oh my God, this was the scene that I watched where I was like, all right. I thought I was ready to watch these movies, and now I think I want to call my mom and be like, I'm sorry about everything. I want to come home.
The American dub, like the girl's voices, you know, it's fine. It's whatever. But the guy, like, you just hear him grunting and talking and saying all that stuff. And the entire time I can only picture that dude that was in all those 2000s Adam Sandler movies. The guy that, like, in Waterboy, he mumbles, and the Waterboy's like, you like to see homos naked? And he's like, nah, nah, homos where the heart is. And, like, that's what this dude sounds like to me. Like, it ruins the uneasiness, because the whole time I'm just like, it's that dude from the Waterboy, you know? Homos where the heart is. So you like to see homos naked. Right on.
Right on, man.
On Shudder, is it the dub still?
Yes. Yeah, Shudder. Oh, Shudder, I think, offers both, but I think you have to like go in and manually adjust it. I cannot remember now. It's been more than a day, so apparently I can't think of it.
I wonder if they still, have cut out some of the gore in the dubbed version, like how it was released. No, or if they
because when I owned it on DVD, I owned the Lionsgate or New Line, whoever released it. I owned that, and it had the dub. As like the manual choice, you had to go in and select subtitles instead. But it was one of those the flip discs, and so it was like side A was uncut and side B was cut.
Okay,
but it didn't matter if it was dubbed or subbed; you could still watch it uncut.
Yeah, I would say even if you're averse to subtitles, this is not a dialogue heavy movie. It's not very distracting. Even if you just put it on the French version and don't even turn on the subtitles if you don't really want to, I mean, you're not going to miss a whole lot.
Yeah, you miss that Jamaican or not Jamaican, but that reggae song. You know, the reggae song I think is the most intense dialogue in the whole movie, and it's like 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah, it's the song that she's listening to after she sees Alex, like, yeah. Naked in the shower.
Yeah.
And that's when she goes upstairs and she puts on, yeah, some weird masturbation music.
Yeah. And it's intercut with the killer arriving,
yeah.
Which, again, something we could read into later. But, yeah, there is a lot of, like, diegetic pop rock songs in this movie. You know, stuff that starts on the radio and enters the soundtrack. I feel like that's something that we see a lot of in horror movies around this time period. And so we haven't really done a plot summary, but there really isn't much of one. It's just this girl and her friend going to the friend's house with her family. Her mom and dad and little brother and dog are there just to study, I guess, and stay out in the French countryside.
The most loose plot imaginable. You don't know what grade they're in. You don't know what they're doing. They're just studying.
Exactly.
It's true. What are they studying? What are their majors?
That's right.
And then it's not very long at all until it's nighttime. She gets done masturbating, and that's where this truck driver just pulls up outside. And, you know, there's no mystery about him. You see him. You see his face the whole time. Kind of reminded me of M. Emmett Walsh, like from Blood Simple.
I kind of thought it was.
It's a little too young looking, I think.
Yeah.
At this point, but
this is after a few years of meth.
And he rings the doorbell, dad goes to answer, and this is where the carnage starts pretty quickly.
Oh my God.
He kills the dog, no mercy for the dog. And then we get, I don't know, probably the most memorable kill in this whole thing, right? Is what happens to the dad.
Yeah.
It's nuts. I really tried to look this time. I have to admit, every time on this podcast I look away. I looked away once again, and this is like the third time I've seen this movie because, yeah, the whole thing is like he like fucks him up and then he's like trying to crawl up the stairs and then he shoves the dad's head through the like little rafter thing on the railing and he's like stuck and bleeding. And then is it like a dresser or something? He like
some kind takes of cabinet.
This cabinet and just for shits and giggles, like slides it across his head and like I don't even know what happens because I look away.
Oh, Seth. He decapitates him with the cabinet in
full the gory whole detail. Thing comes off.
You better believe it, baby.
Whole head comes off.
And then his head,
in one unbroken shot.
His head rolls down his body rolls down the steps after that, doesn't it?
I think it's just still stuck there.
Well, either way, it's one unbroken shot of it smashing his head, of the head coming off, blood spurting out of the neck. And this did have practical effects done by Gianetto De Rossia, who was Lucio Fulci's makeup artist, who made some really disgusting gore films. And as far as from what I can tell, this is at least, you know, a really good example of using practical makeup effects, because he gets to the mother eventually and there's a nice close-up shot of him slashing her throat that almost looks CGI assisted because it's so clear and the blood just starts like gushing out with, you know, without ever like cutting away. But also that could just be really good practical effects work.
Yeah, it does really showcase the blood in this movie is like it is just so red and it is like, it's treating it like the money shot that it is in a slasher movie, right?
And I think that's this is just a great example of what these movies are generally like, where the whole point is really to rub your face in this stuff and be as graphic as possible. And you see that carry over into his Hills Have Eyes film. You see it in a lot of these other movies, again, whether it's Saw or Hostel or Wolf Creek or whatever the movie is. You're going to see the bodies get mutilated.
Going with that, he as a director has some sense of like care, I guess, because the death of the little kid is like the least awful out of any of them. And then in the cut version, I think
how it works,
it's been a long time since I've watched the cut version, but like he shoots the gun and all you hear is like the gun ring out and then like the kid is already two thirds of the way falling into the field, where in the uncut version, you watch him run, you watch it all happen. It goes and goes, like it builds. That tension just keeps rising, you know,
higher and higher.
Yeah. The tension has reached high.
That's right. The tension on high.
As if like to prove that this, you know, he's already killed the dog and everything. Now we got this little brother who's just a really little kid who's running out into the cornfield and killer goes out with a shotgun. And it is interesting that we don't see him get shot. It's implied, but we do later see the body just to confirm, you know, what happened.
Yeah.
And they went there. They killed the kid. It's like Funny Games.
Even beyond just like going the extra length of like killing the kid, that's always like a big move in a horror movie. Like, yeah, you kill all the teenagers and stuff, but like the little kid, that's a big move. But I think there is something really effective about starting or centering a movie, at least like at the beginning, or even like it reminds me of something like Your Next. That's another movie where it's like it's very much about a family unit being threatened. And that is an easy way to hit an audience like where it hurts. Whereas like even in this where we don't know these characters hardly at all, it still is like it's more intense than just some random guy on the street, some silly guy over there, teenagers at a camp. It's always more effective, and at least it is for me, to like start hitting a family really hard. And it's like there's nothing funny about these kills at all. Yeah, it's really intense.
Yeah, this is definitely a home invasion, which I also find to be more disturbing than people, you know, wandering out in the wilderness somewhere or in some other strange setting. But you're also right that there is no character development in this movie, really, for anybody, but especially this family. Like, they don't get so much as, like, a scene of them interacting, really, before all of this stuff starts. And that does blunt it a little bit for me.
Hmm. I guess I just don't think there would be much added for me, I guess. I mean, like, it's already, I guess either do one or the other, like spend a lot of time like really developing them and really making it hurt when they die, which I doubt they would be able to pull off very well. I think this mode is a better idea, and especially as in a movie that's so experiential and about like just the ride, it is better just like make them faceless so that if anything, I'm just thinking about like my own mom, my own dad, or my own family, like in a home invasion situation, because they are just so faceless. It's like, I found that effective.
Faceless until they're headless.
Ouch.
Could we just go through the gas station part and then we can get to the twist?
So be it.
Just in case anyone who hasn't seen the movie yet, eventually the action moves away from the house because the killer puts the friend into the back of his truck. Main character runs out and gets into the truck with her, unbeknownst to the killer, who then takes off. They stop at a gas station. And at this point, I mean, I think probably the most effective part of the movie for me is everything that happens at the house. But we do get kind of another stalking sequence once we get to this gas station, where basically the main character runs inside and tells the gas station attendant to call the police, but then the killer walks right inside and he basically shoves a axe into the clerk's chest and then starts stalking around looking for the girl inside. And I don't know, is this a French thing where they have like giant five stall bathrooms in a little gas station? Because she like hides in these giant bathrooms.
We do not have those.
It feels like if it was a bathroom inside of like one of those truck stops, you know, like if you've been driving on the highway for like 60 miles, as opposed to, yeah, you know, whatever your nearest Sheetz is going to offer you.
Yeah, what the fuck?
I will say real quick before I keep diving into it, as I said at the beginning, the first time I saw this movie, it scared the shit out of me. And the home invasion aspect, you know, it's terrifying on so many different levels. But as someone that's watched so many of these and they all kind of bleed into each other, watching the killer feel the faucet to see how recently someone was in there to like kind of check another room, I thought it was genius. Mm. I thought it was done very yes. well. It was very original compared to, you know, pulling the shower curtain or standing on top of a bed with a shotgun or, you know, anything else.
Yeah, because this isn't just about the gore. There's suspense, you know, sequences too,
yeah,
where lots of sneaking around and creeping and stalking, probably done better than a lot of, you know, slasher movies do.
I think so.
And that's what happens at the gas station. And she does, at this point, she does get on the phone once he's gone to call the police because he takes off. And we do get a little bit of dumb, like, slasher movie behavior there where they're like, well, where are you? And she's like, well, why don't you know where I am? And she won't just, like, go outside to look at the name of the gas station or a street sign or something. She ends up just hanging up and deciding to take off
right.
in a car to chase after
she's
them.
Panicked.
But then we do get a car chase, you know, and to kind of speed to the end so we can talk about the twist. You know, it's just a lot of action. The car flips over. The killer stalks her out to some kind of like greenhouse. He almost smothers her to death with plastic.
Oh, I hate it. It just looks so uncomfortable. Don't do that to me ever. If you're going to kill me, don't do that.
Okay, good to know. Well, and no, instead I'll hold you down and I'll slowly run the razor up and down your body and then I'll shove my finger in your mouth.
That's right.
Like this guy does.
Oh my God. If you do that to me, I'm shoving my crowbar in your shoulder.
So, yeah, we get that's kind of gross where he sticks his like fingers down her throat. That's all right. We're here right at the end. So
here we are. We're there.
She's got this pole that's like wrapped in barbed wire and she uses that to just bash the guy's face in to the point where there's no way he could survive, like just to a pulp. And then she smothers him with the plastic for good measure. And at this point, you know, and you see that there's like, I don't know, 15 minutes of the movie left or so. It does feel on your first viewing a little anticlimactic. Like, all right, we got one villain. He is definitely dead now. Like, what else is there left to do besides go find her friend in the truck? And that's when around this point we cut back to the gas station where the cops are watching the security footage. And dun, 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 it's the girl. Oh, sorry, this is the twist, everyone. It's the girl herself The girl herself runs out with the axe and buries it into the attendant's chest.
Shout out, Jimmy.
It's about the journey there. It's not about the destination and the twist. You know, it's fine. It's not spoiled, okay? I'll just tell you that much. It will be about the experience, but yeah, there it is.
Absolutely. And so we end up with basically she is Tyler Durden, you know? This is the Fight Club twist. That
two spoiled endings in 1 2-minute mark? Come on.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Tyler Durden is a girl the whole time?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Tony, I need you to edit me out altogether. I can't be part of this.
I've already edited myself out.
Can you edit all of us out of this so it's just like dead air for an hour and a half?
Replace me with Jar Jar.
I don't even post half these episodes. No one's ever asked.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought that was... I'm not crazy about how they reveal the twist because, I don't see why not wait a little bit and maybe still use the security footage, but maybe intercut that with her own discovery. She goes to release her friend, and her friend is terrified of her, and she doesn't understand why. And the friend even, like, threatens her with a knife. And I feel like that would be a cooler way to be like, wait, what's going on here? And then we see the footage. I don't know, kind of just dumping it like that was, I feel like, kind of a missed opportunity.
I mean, it's not the most dramatic way you could have done it, but it's still, like, a good unexpected thing. I mean, especially in the throes of a movie that is so conventional at this point, you know, all great film conventions that it's doing aside, I think that it is still like, even though it is like maybe like something that's been done before, it still is shocking in a genre movie like this, regardless of how it's packaged. But yeah, I could agree. There could have been a more creative way of doing it.
Yeah, do you remember, Zach, like the first time seeing this movie, how you reacted to that?
At that time, I thought it was pretty cool. I was 13, so it was pretty exciting just all around. The first time I watched it, I remember just being so like on edge and uncomfortable that like just the ending was exciting to me. You know, I was just like, it's over. I can close my eyes now.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't necessarily think it was bad, but I didn't think it was all that exciting either. I was just like, oh, that's kind of a cop-out. Okay. And then I found out it was based on a short story, and so I guess the overall idea didn't have to be blamed as hard on A-ha, the album, and it was, you know, I could pass it on to someone else.
Yeah, and... I don't know. Now we can kind of start working our way backwards to see like, okay, how does this whole movie fit together with it turning out that this girl's not running from the, or she thinks she's running from the killer, but she also is the killer. And I don't know. I've seen this movie a few times since, you know, knowing what the twist is. And I'm going to say this isn't exactly like a M. Night Shyamalan intricate puzzle box where everything comes together. I think it doesn't really play fair.
Right.
And in the end, it is kind of a dumb twist. You can see clues.
It's so fun.
Well, we'll break it down. It is fun. So I'm of two minds about that because
I don't want to break it down. Like she could have never done this, and she could have never been in two places. Like
going to motherfucker.
No.
How could people build pyramids?
I think my main issue is that. Going back, the explanation for so much of it is just, oh, most of what you're seeing is just completely imaginary with no basis in anything. It were just in her head the whole time. There's very few moments where you can see like a dual reality happening or be like, ooh, that's clever. Oh, Bruce Willis, it looks like he's just got done talking to his wife at dinner and something's wrong. But really, they haven't been talking at all. It's really more like, oh, okay, most of this movie just is shit that didn't happen. And it almost makes the rewatch not so much like, you know, rewarding or fascinating as just kind of pointless. Of like, wow, and so that didn't happen too.
See, I like the rewatch because at least from the standpoint of it being a fantasy for her, these are things that she wants to do. I don't get caught up too much in like doing the math of like, now what actually happened and where was she in like in this situation actually, and like who did she actually kill or whatever. Regardless of like how and when and where she was, these are things she wants to do, and we are getting this like interesting like blurred reality that we're seeing of like both a bit of what actually happens and a bit of what happens in her fantasy, her like power fantasy of like what she wants to do in order to get what she wants, which is Alex. She's in love with Alex and she wants her real bad and wants her all for herself. And also, I don't know. Yeah. Like, how do you explain like the whole, why kill everyone around Alex? Yeah. It is just like this wild, like insane logic that she must be like working through, which is like, I need to eliminate everything that is between us. Like literally, not even that your dad came down and was like, you can never be gay, Alex. Not with her, not with anyone. That never happens. It's just like, no, literally everyone in the world, like it seems, I want them all dead. And I just want us to be here. Like, then I won't have to worry about anyone. I won't have to worry about any boy that you slept with, like she talks about in the beginning of the movie. So it's just crazy.
And then stop at a gas station to kill some random guy for no reason because there is no one chasing you there either.
I don't know. Yeah, we don't know what actually happened. And I feel like we can't know.
Well, and there are clues, you know, starting with that opening scene where she's talking about it like it's a dream. And she says, it was me chasing me. And that right there is almost too obvious when you're back, you know, watching it again. Or the way when the mom is killed and she's like leaning over her and she whispers like, why me, to her, I think, which makes a little sense in hindsight that she's talking to the one who attacked her. And the way her friend is always freaking out when she's around instead of being relieved, you know, after she's tied up. So it does do that stuff, at least. Ebert, actually, he had kind of a funny quote about the twist in this movie. So he said, clever viewers will be able to see for themselves that the movie's plot has a hole that is not only large enough to drive a truck through, but in fact does have a truck driven right through it.
There is a truck.
And that's why you get paid to write lines like that.
That's right.
But that's another question. Where does she get this truck from, too? That's never really, they're not concerned about explaining that.
Yeah, like that, you know, it's, you watch it the second time or you think about the first time and it's just like, how much of it was real? And that's, you know, that's one question itself, sure. But like, it continues to build like in the gas station scene, you know, like the killer knows the dude as Jimmy. He talks to him as a regular. So that's one thing. And I'm like, part of that, you know, it seems like it was actually happening. Part of it, you're watching happen in real time. So there's that. But then, you know, just the concept of her hiding in a stall or kicking stalls open herself, you know, like it just keeps building, but it builds in the opposite direction because it's building against the movie. Like the more logic you add to this movie, the worse it gets as time goes on.
Yeah, I want to see those scenes. I want to see every scene of like her stalking herself for 5 minutes in a bathroom.
Right.
And I want to see her like fighting herself in the green room.
Yeah.
Or the greenhouse for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That might be a more interesting movie.
Where did she get the decapitated head? Did she successfully decapitate the dad? Like,
right. And she's just imagining some guy getting a head from a decapitated head. Or that's not even something that anybody witnesses in the movie.
Right.
That's just like a trick on the viewer. It's just misdirection.
Right.
It's making so you can't guess the twist because it just seems like, oh, well, I mean, it just, that would never fit. That's, the movie hasn't laid the groundwork for that. So there's no way to guess it.
Yeah. And I won't give this like all the passes. It's a lot of convenient arguments that the director has set up in order to make it kind of easier on him to like, it was just kind of half and half reality and half fantasy. Yeah. Like, how is she pulling up with a truck and who did she kill? How'd she get ahead? Like, I don't know. It all starts to fall apart and just become like very obviously a dream. Yeah. And I mean, by the time she does get out that big old saw, I love that whole sequence when she gets the concrete saw from the killer. Well, she is the killer. We know that she's the killer.
She willed it into existence.
Yeah. we cut in a way that she becomes the killer again, now that we know that she's the killer, and she's brandishing it, again, going back to the sexual stuff, at Alex like it's a big old penis the whole time, which goes back to, like, yeah, like, she couldn't be a man for this girl, like, she chose this boy over her, and she's brandishing this saw and stuff, and she's asking her, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Over and over again.
Very sex queer positive messaging here.
I kill all the boys who don't, you know, kiss me. I gotta say.
That's right.
Oh, man. You know, as a teenager, all the time I masturbated, it was, you could fill a landfill with bodies of all of the people who died.
He's just jacking off, knife in one hand.
Just mass graves. So yeah, at least the last scene of this movie, we're all on the same page. We kind of cut between her chasing the friend with the saw and then back as her imaginary M. Emmett Walsh truck driver guy. But there are still some kind of dumb things that happen after that point. Like, I don't know, when she gets into this guy's car to escape and he like just stopped his car to let her in and then he can't get it to start again. Like, okay, that's right, we're in a slasher movie. And then also when so the guy that's rescuing her.
Oh, the dude explodes in blood.
Yeah.
Crazy.
The killer is shoving the buzzsaw like through the windshield, and she spends like what feels like 2 straight minutes just killing this guy, and the friend just sits there and screams instead of getting out of the car. So no one to blame but herself at that point.
Mark, you know, look me up when you're in that car, okay? And let me know what you're doing. Let me know how well you're handling the situation.
I'll be getting the fuck right? out. That's I'm what sure. I'll be doing. I'll be getting out.
I think that Mark is really here to teach us how to react to poor situations. Seth and I are over here, you know, experiencing fear in the moment, and Mark's just like, that's not a thing.
Pull up your britches, get out of the car.
The only thing you have to fear is fear itself, so fuck it. As Siskel and Ebert once said, get out of that car.
That is a long tradition of horror and slasher movies, right? Where people sit in the audience, they go, run, run, no, don't go in there. You idiot. So whatever, I'll give her points for maybe being in a panic. We get a nice, another really gross gore shot of her like pulling this piece of glass out of her Achilles tendon while she's on the ground.
Oh, I forgot about that. I looked away.
Yeah, and basically we get she kind of lures her over with a kiss. She kisses the killer as kind of a means to distract her and then impales her with a crowbar, which I would have to imagine is not an easy thing to impale a person with.
Girl boss.
Yeah.
Power of friendship.
So yeah, that's high tension basically. And I am kind of two minds about this whole twist because it is dumb. It does make the rewatch seem almost like a waste of time at points. However, if this movie had just ended with her killing the killer and that was it, this would be such a more run-of-the-mill slasher movie than what we end up with. So I think in the end, I am pro the twist. The alternative is just the movie ending after he kills the guy. So and it's like the most distinguishing thing about it is also the silliest thing. But I'll give it points for that. I don't think I would like this movie better without it. So the question then is, would anybody unwatch this if they could? And I would say no. I mean, I'm not a huge fan. I think it's pretty dumb, but I wouldn't unwatch it. I mean, it's not like it was disturbing, really.
Well, me and Zach have both watched it multiple times. So, spoiler.
Never too late to unwatch.
I think if there was something about it to be unwatched, maybe unwatching at the age of 13, it really like it made me truly understand the fear of home invasion. I saw Black Christmas a couple years prior. I had seen Halloween already, you know, but like Black Christmas, I was like, okay, you know, there's actual things to be afraid of inside your own home. But then watching High Tension, I was just like, yeah, fuck that. Like, you're not safe anywhere. So I guess maybe waiting a couple years to watch it, but
oh, man.
Then maybe I wouldn't be here talking about it with Tony and Seth and Mark and Activia.com.
Thank you, Activia.
Black Christmas walked so that High Tension could run.
That's right. Yeah.
So this next movie comes at the kind of the tail end of the new French extremity trend, as loosely organized as it is. And that is Martyrs from 2008 from the director Pascal Logie. And he has made a few movies since. There is one that's called The Tall Man from 2012. And I saw that it starred Jessica Biel. And I was like, well, that sounds interesting. I wonder what that's like. And clicked over to it on Letterboxd and saw that I had watched and rated it and have no memory of it.
It's bad.
Yeah. That must have been why.
This is a We Love Jessica Biel podcast episode. First the Texas Chainsaw remake, now The Tall Man.
Yeah, yeah. And strangely enough, Martyrs had an American remake in 2015, like a fully Americanized.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I read a summary of it. I'm certainly not going to watch it.
It's on Tubi if anyone does want to see it.
Oh, good, good. And yeah, it sounds like it goes full, like the second half, they have like a whole revenge thing and totally turn it on its head. But I would say the original Martyrs of all these movies maybe has the biggest reputation as, you know, this is the ultimate endurance test, that this is the top of the pile of the, you know, can you sit through Martyrs? And I mean, I'll be interested to see if everybody agrees with that or not. It is definitely not High Tension, although there is High Tension. And I'm not going to even summarize the whole thing because I feel like so much of this depends on a series of narrative altering twists, like one after another after another. So, but the basic setup is that we open seeing this little girl, Lucy, escaping from captivity. She's being held and tortured in some sort of dank, abandoned building, and nobody knows who captured her or why. And she does escape and manages to grow up in this home or something where she meets a lifelong friend, Anna. And at the same time, we kind of realize that she is being stalked by this golem-like creature, which is very J-horror, like very stringy-haired kind of specter that I guess is following her around her whole life.
So gross.
That's basically the setup, because after we learn all of that stuff and they still don't know who captured her or what's going on with the creature, we flash to 15 years later. And this is, I think, one of the most memorable parts of the movie, where we're suddenly with this family, this idyllic kind of upper middle class family having breakfast, and they don't seem related to anything else. There's a father and a wife and this teenage son and daughter. And we spend a little scene with them kind of bantering and interacting.
The daughter just won a soccer championship. And the son's figuring out what he wants to do with school.
Yeah, and there's this little subtle like zoom into a newspaper article about the girl's accomplishment, which is a neat little bit of misdirection too, because you're thinking like, oh, okay, this is an important character. This
right.
is something
yeah.
significant that's going on, right? And dad goes to answer the door in the middle of their, you know, breakfast conversation. And what happens, Seth?
This bitch runs in and shoots them all with a shotgun. Real hardcore, like
every one of them.
That's what happened.
The whole family, kids and parents, she blasts them graphically away. And the person doing it, we learn, is the slightly older Lucy.
Yeah. Who did we gloss over, sort of? Like, she's at, like, what even is it? Is it an asylum for little kids? Is it just an orphanage where they meet her and the other girl?
Didn't seem clear to me.
I don't think it's an orphanage. I think it's it seems more focused on their like mental well-being.
Yeah, after she escapes and everything, that's where she goes.
Yeah, and we never learn why her friend Anna seems to be there also.
Which, that's all like shot really weird. It's like shot like like Super 8 camera. And it has some of the worst looking credits I've ever seen. They all look like these horrible, like the font that you write Saw in or something, like real rusty metal letters as the font for the credits. I thought that was really funny.
Microsoft Word art.
That's right.
But all that aside, we established that Lucy's only friend is this other girl who like believes her and believes that she's been through like all this crazy stuff and is stalked by this demented, crazy, naked woman. And after Lucy grows up and now just killed a whole family, at least at first, to us for like no reason, which makes that whole scene, it's a long scene too, and it makes that scene very just like, wait, hang on, who is this? What is happening? And you're just like, keep on asking that, and it's just the answers are not coming, but we do get them when she runs out of the house and calls her friend and basically explains what's happened, that it was a revenge killing, that these were the people, she says, these were the people that did that to her.
Yeah, and it definitely does not seem like it makes any sense at all that this family had anything to do with her being kidnapped. And like you said, it's really like shockingly abrupt the way that she blows away the dad and the mom. But she does have a moment with the teenage son, you know, where he sits down and she's kind of deciding like if she's going to kill him, which she then just abruptly does. And then she stalks the girl, shoots her through a bed.
Fucking brutal.
Yeah. And so she does decide to kill the children too. And then, yeah, Anna shows up and is basically helping her move the bodies and going along with the whole thing while still it being clear that she's not sure this is the right thing.
Yeah, because she's like, you were just supposed to watch them. You were supposed to call me and report to me what was happening.
Yeah, and that even leads to a little bit later where this family seemed to have been dead for quite a while and suddenly the mom just springs to life.
Right.
Like, you know, with her body in the bathtub. And Anna does try to, like, sneak her out to save her because she doesn't believe Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
But Lucy gets on top of that and bashes the mom's head in, like, to a pulp with a hammer.
Dude, you see the dent. Like, it is... Ooh.
I didn't see the dent. I had to look away.
Seth, come on.
Oh, poor delicate Seth.
I had to do it. It's too much.
These people aren't really dying. You know that, right?
I know. You've said this to me before, but it still doesn't work. It still doesn't work. In the throes of the moment, but yeah, definitely some extreme shit going on. It's definitely
some French
borderline
extremity.
Like unbelievable, like just how brutal some of it is, and the sound effects, like even just like they're pulling some of the bodies to like hide them in the woods, and it's just like thud plop. It's just like every bit of this that can be like drawn out and made gross is made gross and drawn out for sure.
Yeah, and I feel like this part of the movie is a little more in like high tension territory as far as it's not really focused on the suffering and the like body mutilations so much as these big sudden murders. They're so far it's all with a shotgun, and it is definitely shocking just on a narrative level that suddenly everyone's getting killed. But it doesn't really seem at this point like this is a torture porn movie, or maybe even what you would be suspecting from this movie if you only know it by reputation. So, I mean, Seth, this was your first time watching it, right?
Yeah, it feels like a really fucked up thriller at this point. And you just feel really rudderless because the person I'm supposed to be, like I thought was like the main character who I was empathizing with because she had like been through abuse in this mysterious way and like is like was clearly going through some shit, and now is like she just killed these people in this horrible way, and like I don't know who I'm like looking towards. It's really intense, like right from the get-go.
I feel like this movie throws a lot at us really quickly as it's starting.
I love that.
From going through the time period so quickly to 15 years later to the meeting this family. And then even after the family has been killed, the Gollum shows up again and
the
is
slicing
her back and attacking her. So we have this other level that seems like supernatural on top of it being this thriller. And it almost seems like too many elements to figure out exactly what kind of movie this is and what's going on.
Fucking prog rock.
Because this figure is back and still attacking the shit out of Lucy, and Anna has to like sew her back up together.
I think that scene is a really good scene because she's telling Anna, and you can hear in Anna's voice, she's just like, yeah, it's the naked woman. Yep, I get it. You know, like you can kind of see that if you didn't already believe it, this is a great point to believe that Anna does not want to be here anymore. You know, like it's gone too long. It's gone too far. She does not believe anything that's going on anymore is a normal approach to any of this. Like, you can tell that she's trying to push through it, moving bodies, you know, washing things up, cleaning them up, but then just like, oh, the girl came back. She's just like, fuck, dude, like, I'm stuck. I am like actually stuck in this. And I think it's a very, very powerful scene, as they say in the film podcast that I listen to.
That's how Ebert would put it.
That's right. Yeah. Shout out my boy Ebert.
Using the P word.
And so if we're just getting our bearings at this point, after the mom comes back to life, Lucy bashes her head in, before we can even start to get into the rhythm of things, this monster is back. And it's basically, you know, intercut with Anna watching Lucy be attacked. But what she sees is Lucy slicing herself up, that there's no monster there. She slices her, like, her wrists and her whole arms to basically commit suicide, and then runs outside and, you know, slits her own throat open. Another very nasty scene.
Mm-hmm.
She, like, runs through a window. It's so awesome and horrible. And she also, like, bashes her head against a wall. And then she runs through the window. And then, like, it's like, is it raining? It's, like, raining outside. And Anna...
You can watch all this, but you can't watch someone get shot at the breakfast table?
I guess. I don't know. I don't know how my brain works. Sorry about the background noise. Somebody's landing a helicopter.
So this is kind of like our third twist already, that not only is it basically revealed that this ghoul is just in her head and she's actually cutting herself, which raises some questions like how she managed to slice her back up so thoroughly on her own. But
also
she's dead now. So this was supposed to be one of our two main characters, and now she is gone. So yet again, we have the narrative rug pulled out from under us before we even barely got onto our feet.
It's not that kind of movie, and it's not that kind of movie, and now it's not that kind of movie.
Yes. And that takes us right into our fourth twist, which really I feel like I can just plot this out just by the twists at this point, because now that Lucy is dead, Anna then starts snooping around the house for some reason and discovers a secret passageway and a dungeon, and leading down to an actual, you know, torture place.
Like a facility. It's like, it's definitely different than the flashbacks you see of, like, where the other girl was being tortured.
This one feels so much more medical.
Yeah.
Where the flashback ones just felt fucked up, but like in like a abandoned industrial building kind of way.
And this is where we get the first, like, religious sort of undercurrents, because down in this underground hallway, you get these pictures that almost look like, I don't know, like Madonnas or something, like in a church, but they're pictures of just people being mutilated and tortured, but they all have this specific, like, strange look in their eye.
Yeah, and one thing that is the same is it's the same metal chair that has a hole in the bottom so they can pee into a bucket.
That hasn't changed.
That we know that the little girl had. So these are the same people. We don't necessarily know that the children knew anything about it, but... So, yeah, now it turns out, so Lucy was right. These people were doing that. And not only that, but she finds their latest victim there, who is this just emaciated, scarred all over her body lady, who also has these kind of metal blinders that are attached to her head.
With staples.
And she doesn't seem to be able to speak. And so, she helps this very disturbing-looking lady upstairs, at which point... I guess even with this discovery, doesn't feel like, you know, getting an ambulance or anything involved. But she does take her into a bathtub and very gruesomely pry out the staples out of this lady's skull so she can get this thing off of her head.
Well, I don't think she's going to call an ambulance, because right now she's, like, implemented in killings, basically, right? Like, she doesn't know what to do.
Sure, but it has... Circumstances have changed a little bit.
I thought that it was kind of implied, just based on the way she looked and everything. I thought that was the actual woman that Lucy was seeing when she was a kid. Like when she gets called a slut and goes into that room and sees a woman being tortured. That vision combined with her as the girl from The Grudge that she sees as an adult, I thought they were just kind of coming together in a, it's been 15 years, it's been a continued torture type deal, blah, blah, blah. I just thought it was the same woman.
I think you're right, right? So it is, this is the woman that she saw and inspired these nightmares, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
These nightmare visions of the Gollum woman. And this is the real Gollum woman who is still Gollum-like, but a little bit more, less Gollum-like, but still, like, she's terrifying. Like, she is, like, twitchy and, like, constantly shaking, and it's really disturbing.
The staple scene, Becca watched this with me, as I said at the beginning, and that was the scene where Becca and I both, like, made a noise. Because there was a couple points in the movie where I was like, are you okay? And Becca was like, yep, I'm good. And I was just like, all right. But then I was like, oh no. And Becca, I think, just kind of like groaned a little bit. And I was just like, yeah, this is it. This is definitely like kind of the shift into what I was anticipating. The first third of the movie, I was just like, yep, this sucks, but it's okay. It didn't feel as extreme as I was anticipating, where this, I was just like, yes, this is it. This is the thing that makes me uncomfortable.
I think that was the grossest part of the movie for me, is the makeup job on this lady and that scene. Yeah, that really did, was kind of skin crawling. And if I was that lady, I'd be like, you know, let's just leave the staples be for now. We can maybe do that later when I make my way to a hospital and they put me under anesthesia. Like, we're good. I'll keep this on. But that would deny us some gooey grossness. So anyways, now we seem to be going in another direction with this. This lady starts freaking out and trying to like saw off her arm or hand or something. And Anna
it's horrible.
Chases her out into the hallway. And then, boom, this whole crew of people arrive, shoot the lady. So we get yet another unceremonious, death of a character that we just met. And basically, this is our next. I've lost track of all the twists at this point, but at this point is when this whole secret society arrives and takes Anna, and they clearly are in on this with the family.
They look like secret agents.
Yeah, they do. They do, and that's where they take Anna, and we have this old lady, the Madame, come in and basically explain everything that's going on to her. So she talks about this secret society who wants to inflict as much suffering as they can on a subject to find the martyr who can basically persevere through so much physical suffering that they transcend their body and they see life after death. And apparently women are more sensitive to this transformation. And that's what Lucy was kidnapped for all those years ago. Apparently they've been trying for 15 years with this last lady, and they were like, let's just blow her head off now after 15 years of putting some work into it.
Yeah, French Extremity, they are very certain to mention the fact that we tried children, okay? Don't get it twisted. We tried to torture children, all right? It didn't work.
Exactly. Lucy was a kid. And now Anna is going to become the next subject to become a martyr. And that's basically the whole rest of the movie after that. So this is a really strangely structured film where you have this like first half that is just rug pull after rug pull after rug pull. Then it settles into this final like 35 minutes or so, which is just the torturing of Anna. And I think that's what people think of when they think of this movie for the most part. And we basically are walked through this whole process, which isn't very complicated. You know, she's chained to a chair, they cut her hair, and we just see over and over again. Like, there's basically two parts to her torturing. Somebody comes and feeds her this green gruel that she has to swallow, and if she doesn't want to, they slap her. And then that's alternated with some giant guy who comes in and unchains her and just slaps and punches and beats her till she's like unconscious, basically. And they just go back and forth. I actually started to count because it was so like repetitive that We get three scenes of her eating the gruel and four scenes of this giant guy just beating the shit out of her.
The first time he goes to beat her up, he unchains her, but he doesn't unchain her any of the other times. So that first time he unchains her, that combined with the way that the madame was talking to her, I was like, oh, they're going to like make her one of the like the special people, you know, they're going to give her that black jacket. And so I was just like, sure, all right. And then like he just starts beating the shit out of her. And I was like, oh, no, I greatly misunderstood this.
Oh, it's an even more special person.
That's there. Right.
The martyr.
Yeah. And this is weird. Like, I don't know. This movie has this reputation for being, you know, the ultimate endurance test. And yet this whole like torture sequence, it's like for this whole, you know, society that's highly organized and idealizes suffering and has been going on for decades. They're not very creative about their torture. They literally just like, all right, a couple times a day, this guy's going to slap the shit out of you and then leave. Like there's nothing creative going on there. Yeah. You know, there's not even like hostile type stuff. There's no like pulling out their fingernails or something. It's just like this, a guy like punching the shit out of her, which is not fun to watch, especially with it being this giant guy, you know, but it's not really, it's not that graphic. And I don't know. I was always surprised when I saw this movie that I didn't actually find it that hard to watch, at least compared to, I don't know. I feel like The Passion of the Christ is about 100 times more like brutal and prolonged as far as torturing someone to martyrdom.
It's true. Only the end of like her the torture scene, like the final like torture is like really intense. But before that, yeah, you're right. It is pretty tame, like comparatively speaking. It does fit sort of what's going on, I guess. I like that the torturers go down there and they aren't like enjoying it. They aren't like getting off on it or anything. You can see it's very mechanical.
It's like a science to them. Yeah, yeah. They see it as just like this is what has to happen in order to see if we can achieve this. You know, if we can find that fourth martyr in the last how much time.
Yeah, the guy's just like clocking in for the day. And like afterwards, he's probably going like to his other job, you know, Burger King.
Exactly.
And then now it's time to beat the shit out of our martyr.
Well, and the old lady kind of explains it in a way that the true trick to torturing someone is doing it in this such way. You repeat it, you do it coldly, you build them up just enough to knock them back down to two more pegs, and you just kind of like let them coast along in a way that they continue to ride it out. And it seems like such a much bigger picture to her as an individual, where everyone else below her, it comes back to like what you were just saying, Seth, where they see it as a methodical thing. And I think that the repetition, while it sullies the ability to make it a truly graphic and fucked up movie, after, this sounds awful to say, but after the second time of watching that woman get beat, you're just like, yeah, okay, well, at least she's gonna live through it, that's fine. It really furthers that idea of just true fucked up torture,
right? And the true martyr, probably in their eyes, if I'm kind of reading into it, but maybe the true martyr is the one who through the repetition will find a way of rising above it.
Yeah.
Or becoming like going to this like otherworldly state to escape it. It almost is like a Rocky montage or something, because like they introduce the gruel again and she's like eating it just fine. She doesn't spit any of it out. She swallows it, right?
There's this piano music like playing underneath it eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
But you're right. They really should have put like Eye of the Tiger under it. And show her like, yeah, man, Jesus. I'm going to take this gruel. I'm going to absorb these blows. But it does seem that it's building to when they finally take her out of there for phase four and they strap her to this like spinning gyroscope device and cut off her clothes. And they skin her alive, basically head to toe. But we don't see it at all. So even that that was something that I was like, oh man, here we go. This is going to be the thing.
Yeah, I found that interesting.
It just cuts to right afterwards and you just get to see her in this kind of, you know, like bodysuit makeup job, which is, you know, gross and slimy. But
oh, yeah.
At that point,
horrible.
Wasn't really focused on her suffering. She just comes out afterwards. So
she looks like Frank from the first Hellraiser.
Yes. Yeah, because it's just her face is left on. Kind of the opposite of how, like, Leatherface would take their faces off. She just gets to keep the face. They take everything else.
Leatherface is running around with her bodysuit.
There's got to be a foil to Leatherface. So it's the person that is, you know, leather body.
There you go.
But yeah, I did find that interesting. I couldn't even figure out, like, did they skin her? Did they burn her? I wasn't even sure. Again, yeah, interesting for a movie that is, like, really interested in showing you, like, horrible shit. They just cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in that way, I feel like we kind of get off easy. And that's kind of the end of that stuff in the movie, too. So I don't think it's that hard to get through. But we do then, at some point, after that, one of the people who, I don't know, works there or whatever, comes like shrieking into the room that she's like, oh, look, like I've never seen an expression like this on her face. She's liberated, completely liberated, which is a really like high billing then for them to show us her face where she's just kind of like gaping forward. It's almost would have been better if they didn't show us her face because... like, how does that look any different from somebody who is just kind of zonked out?
Right, yeah. Someone that just had all of their skin cut off looks
right.
About the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. We're seeing them reading into the situation, like, what they want to see, right? It's like, yeah, you probably haven't seen an expression like that, at least... maybe they haven't tried this method, even.
But make no mistake, it does work. She does become a martyr, and they immediately call the madam to come hear her secret. And, you know, they have her floating in a bathtub like one of the precogs in Minority Report, like just ready to give her, like, her wisdom. That's another thing where madam leans over, and we see her mouth move as she's whispering something to her. And just the fact that this epiphany is something that she could just kind of verbally sum up in a few sentences and just, like, tell her something. I don't know. I think the whole idea is really silly of what they're putting her through. It's kind of hard for me to get too disturbed by any of this when they're like, oh, she's got the secret to life after death now.
Oh, no way. I'm in. I can see. I mean, it's about the foolishness of the cult.
But they're right. That she does tell her the secret of life after death. She does transcend herself.
Well, we don't know that. That's the whole thing. Like, we have that whole sequence which we didn't talk about, which is a crazy aspect of this, where they zero into her eyeball while she's lying there bleeding. And we see this whole, like, white light, and it's like a psychedelic sort of light show for a second. It's like digital whatnot is going on. So we're, like, maybe seeing what she's seeing, which is, like, implied to be the other side, at least if we're
right.
I don't know if we're taking it seriously. I mean, that's sort of the confusing thing, because it does land on this place, because she, yeah, the cult arrives and they have this whole speech, like, you're like, she did it, can you believe it? And then the madam goes up and she shoots herself after hearing the secret.
You guys are really underselling it.
That's the big punchline. She's about to tell everybody.
There you go.
Yeah. That's the whole stinger of the movie, that they call everyone there. It's kind of like the cult in Being John Malkovich, like all the old people show up and they're like, all right, now we're finally going to see the transformation, or we're going to hear what the secret is of life after death. And the madam is, I can't remember exactly what she says.
She says something to the guy and she's like, don't you want to know what truly happens, you know, what it's really like? And he's like, yeah, of course. And she's like, keep wondering. And then just blows her fucking brains out.
Like, what she heard was too profound and made her kill herself. And now they have to go on wondering. Yeah. And that's it.
Pretty badass, if you ask me.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different ways you can, like, imagine what is said. I mean, it could also just be gibberish. and she knows it's gibberish. Like, and after all this, like, yet another one, like, we, like, this is the closest maybe they came or something like that. And they still, it's just gibberish. So, yeah, she shoots herself because it was all for naught.
Well, I don't know about that reading, because she's really careful. The guy keeps asking her, like, and she told you, and it was clear, and she's like, oh, yes, no room for interpretation. And she's very methodically taken off her eyelashes, and they've called the whole, you know, society there to tell them.
Well, I figure that's another aspect of this. It's, she's like any cult leader. Quite often, it's like at least a little aware that maybe what she's peddling is bullshit, right?
I don't get that vibe from her. I don't know.
And maybe, or at least has had that sort of doubt going on in her mind. Which, yeah, we don't have a lot to go on with this character. We don't spend a lot of time with her. So it is, I get it, it's a vibe. So, but that's an interpretation that I think is pretty valid too.
Well, the specific words that she uses there, she asks him, like, could you imagine what awaits after death? Is like how she phrases it. And he like asks if she's okay. And she like clarifies again and like asks the same question. And then he says no, that he's like sure he couldn't imagine. And she says, well, keep doubting. That's the last line. And then she blows her head off. So there is a way to read that where it's like, oh, yeah, like keep doubting that you could figure this out. But like now that I know, you know, fuck this whole bullshit we're doing here. So who knows? Maybe she just whispers a bunch of just insane person going into shock nonsense. And it's like, oh, this whole thing that I had, I was barking way up the wrong tree or something, but I don't know. I don't know that that there's enough substance there for it to really warrant like that kind of deep analysis, but that is to keep doubting is the last line. So that's at least something.
I think, I don't know. I feel like the irony is supposed to be that she knows and will kill herself before she can tell anybody. That's supposed to be like the Twilight Zone twist at the end, the guy left alone on the planet, able to read all the books, and then he breaks his glasses, and then the episode ends.
That's the coolest reading.
See, this just seems weird, so random.
She finds out what Bill Murray says at the end of Lost in Translation, and she just doesn't she doesn't know what to do with all that power.
I know. Who would I tell? No one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hear that. I'm open to any interpretation when it comes to this sort of thing, was Lost in Translation sort of thing that we're not privy to.
Yep. And it's right cut to black at that point. Then they give us like the dictionary definition of martyr, which means witness, which is always, you know, usually you start your term paper by defining the word that you're talking about.
Yeah, we're actually supposed to watch it backwards. We fucked it up.
There you go.
Ooh, it's one of those Satan messages.
That's right.
I think we're picking apart this dumb movie too much.
Well, you think it's dumb, and I do not. That's the thing.
Yeah, no, that is my opinion. And especially the way that it goes, when it cuts to black at the end, and it goes back to like showing the home videos of the little girls together. I think that just kind of underscored for me that this movie is so scattered that it doesn't, the girls' relationship, you know, doesn't end up really mattering at all. That this isn't a story about the two of them. Even the ghoul, the golem thing turns out to just be a red herring, almost like an excuse to throw in a grudge monster when really that doesn't go anywhere.
It's just awesome.
Exactly. But it's just awesome. That's it.
Nothing can be just awesome if it's awesome.
Oh, Seth, I think it can. Where it's so much of it just seems like kind of a, there's too many psycho type twists. It's like as if Marion Crane gets to the hotel and she's murdered and we switch protagonists, but then Norman walks out the door and he gets murdered. And then we find out about Mother, but we just kind of explain her away with a line. And actually we move on to something else that's happening. Too much for me.
It was all about the husband or that boyfriend at the beginning that wouldn't marry her.
There you go. Yeah. It's about him. And then maybe the detective afterwards.
Here's what I'll say. It gave me heavy, Natalie Portman and V for Vendetta vibes.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. I didn't want to make that reference and then like have someone boo me, but yeah.
Well, I liked the movie a lot, but I couldn't help but like, when did the comic come out? Might have been something they were sneaking in there, but it is kind of like that. It's a secret facility that is there to torture you until you are set free.
Yeah. Wow, man, Seth, I can never get a handle on you.
What?
You're so like squeamish about, you know, this movie and everything, or at least going into it. And I never know if you're going to be like, oh yeah, I loved it, or this was too much. You're always keeping me on my toes.
I know. I mean, this proves that there was something more to it by the end to me. That's the big thing, or at least the thing that it's playing with, even though that you could interpret it that there isn't anything, right? That she did just say gibberish and there's nothing on the other side of death and this was all for nothing. That is what I find interesting about this, because that is always the thing about like torture porn, that it's always this useless exercise and it's just excess and it's just gross for the sake of being gross. This at least, this is an interesting sort of back and forth about that, where it's like, what if there is some crazy reason why we would do something like that?
Okay, yeah, no, that point is well taken, I think. And the maybe that's why this movie keeps getting held up as the ultimate example of this genre, is because in a way it's about the torture and the suffering instead of just foregrounding it for the sake of it. So I see that.
I do agree that it's wild and flailing and like kind of insane. Yes, absolutely.
Well, so where do you land with this then, Zach? Because I don't know. I rated this low enough on Letterboxd and found enough of it like tedious that I would say for the purposes of this podcast that I would unwatch it. But where do you land qualitatively, Zach?
I think this is where I have the upper hand of it not being my podcast, so I can just be so middle of the road on it and like it's a cop out. But that seems lame and I don't want to do that. I don't want to say I would unwatch it. I feel like saying I've seen it can put me at the cool kids table if I have to be, but also, you know, I can tell like the average person that it's not, you know, gonna ruin their lives if they do or don't see it. You know, it's a nice balance for me. I don't think it was great. I think I rated it like a 3 on Letterboxd. There was only maybe 5 minutes that made me feel gross, where I was anticipating I was going to spend 2 hours trying to peel my own eyeballs out. And yeah, it's a movie.
Damn it. That's all I was trying to say. It's a movie.
Yeah, I would say it actually it's not nearly as unwatchable as you would think, let alone right. For it being on this podcast. I just didn't like it, and that's why I was on that side.
It lives in infamy with so many people, you know? Like, it's considered, like, this nearly taboo thing to so many people. But really, it's just, there's a lot of plot for a movie that should just be gross, grimy torture, and then there's not a lot of actual torture for a movie that should have so much fucking plot. Like,
that's because it's a science fiction movie.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. Yeah.
I watch movies to figure out what happens after death. So that's really why I'm here. Okay.
Yeah, me too. The real martyr is the viewer.
Damn.
Boing, 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 boing. Sorry. Well, Zach, I want to thank you for joining us and bringing your passion for horror and your history with these movies along with you. I had a lot of fun during this conversation bouncing these ideas off you guys.
Yeah, you know your shit.
I'm honored. That means a lot. Let me know if you want to talk about other fucked up movies.
Absolutely.
That's kind of our thing on this. Yeah.
Let me know if you want to do a whole podcast about fucked up movies.
Is there anything you wanted to plug? I know you were saying there's like a new Griphook album.
So September 21st or 22nd, I don't remember, whatever the last day of summer is, that's when the second Griphook album comes out. We've got a split with Porcupine, who are a really good Chicago band. Our half's been done since February. I have no idea when that comes out. Let's hope and pray it's fucking July 19th.
That's very cool.
I don't know. I think that's pretty much it. You can find me on all the Insta and the Twitter and all that. I've got a link tree. It's linktree.com/ZachButcher. Griphook has a link tree. It's /GriphookBand. You can follow me on Twitter and see my insane tweets. You can follow me on Instagram and see cute pictures of my animals. I'll be your friend on Facebook even. I don't really care. I'm on Letterboxd. I just don't remember what my Letterboxd is, but that's in my link tree.
We will link to Zach for every single website that he has a presence on in the episode description.
Cool.
LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me do this. I really appreciate it. Listen to my band. We're the best band in all of Ohio.
All right.
Oh, man. Could we close out the episode with one of your band's songs and you won't try to copyright strike our YouTube video? I bet it would actually still get copyright stricken, but...
Yeah, you can do whatever you want. I don't give a fuck, man. I support you.
We do like to pull out songs from the movies when we can, and and High Tension does feature a song by my personal favorite hardcore band, Muse.
Yeah. Yeah. How could I forget that? I fuck, dude. Yeah, that's the car chase scene, right? Yeah.
Well, yeah. If all that stuff falls through, we can end with the reggae song.
That's right. That's,
and the sound of Seth masturbating.
That's what I want. Yeah.
And just a little girl who remained. It was already in my notes.
Don't stop your running wild and change your style, then they're gonna get spoiled, you know?
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti, hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.
Cause you're just a little runaway child, ain't gonna run and whine, you know. Just a regular style, and you're still another little girl, so you gotta remain a little girl now.
Just another girl.